Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says intelligence coming from Iraq indicates that the U.S. is seeking to fabricate a pretext for war. European Aerospace Corporation Airbus urges Europe to respond appropriately to a U.S. decision to expand its tariffs on aircraft components. The British Prime Minister's father says that he's applying for a French passport to maintain his ties with the European Union after Brexit. Welcome. The top story, Iranian Foreign Minister says that the United States is seemingly plotting to initiate a war in the region, warning the country against such a move. Mohammad Javad Zarif says that intelligence from Iraq indicates that Washington's intention to fabricate a pretext for war. Zarif says that Iran does not seek a war, but will openly and directly defend its people, security, and vital interests. He criticized President Trump and those he described as his cohorts for deploying nuclear-capable B-52 bombers and armadas to the region instead of fighting COVID-19 back at home. Earlier this month, Trump accused Iran of playing a role in the attacks on the U.S. embassy premises in Iraq, threatening retaliation. President Hassan Rouhani says that the Iranian nation won't forget the U.S. assassination of General Soleimani.
We will never forget the assassination of General Soleimani. It was a great tragedy. We will always be mourning for him, as well as for Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis. The Iranian nation and countries in the region will avenge their killing at an appropriate time.
Rouhani also slammed the U.S. for the quote, savage assassination, and denounced President Trump for personally ordering the killing. The Iranian president hailed the general for his role in bringing peace and security to the region. He said that Soleimani was a source of pride for Muslims as he brought dignity to regional countries and beyond. In Syria, people have gathered in the city of Bukamal to mark the anniversary of the assassination of Iran's top commander. Addressing the crowd, the Iran ambassador to Syria, Javad Turkabadi, said that Lieutenant General Soleimani sacrificed himself for the people of Syria and Iraq as he wanted to bring back peace and stability to those countries and the entire region. He said that Soleimani wanted for the people of Iran and Syria to be united, and he died for that cause. Turkabadi said that those who assassinated the general are in a state of defeat and definitely will pay the price for their heinous crime. The Iranian diplomat also praised the role of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad in the resistance against the U.S. and terrorist groups. A correspondent from Damascus, Mohammed Ali, tells us how important Soleimani's presence was in Syria as regards fighting Daesh and U.S. plots against that country.
His presence here was to fight this plot in general, in order to stop the spread of those terrorists who were being used as agents by those countries in order to steal and loot the natural resources of Syria in order to be present illegally over here. Like the United States, for example, we're seeing how it occupies many parts of Syria, how it's assisting the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces in looting the natural resources, the oil of Syria. We're seeing how the United States is continuing its airstrikes on various parts of the country, undermining security, also trying to divide this resistance front, also trying to divide Syria. General Soleimani was here for this mission in order to foil this plot by the United States, Israel, and their Western and regional allies, and fight those terrorist groups that are the tools of those countries. So his presence was very important. He gave strength whenever he was here on the front lines to all the fighters, and he scared all of the enemies on the other side wherever he was present.
A U.S. Policy research group has sued President Trump's administration in an effort to block a multi-billion-dollar arms deal with the UAE. In a lawsuit, the New York Center for Foreign Policy Affairs said that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo has rushed the deal without proper oversight or justification. The group is seeking a court order forcing Pompeo and the State Department to annul the transaction, arguing that an inadequate approval process violated the Administrative Procedure Act. The Senate failed this month to block the $23 billion sale to Abu Dhabi despite objections to a package of F-35 jets and drones as part of a so-called Middle East peace deal. Pompeo said that the weapons would address the UAE's need for advanced defense capabilities to deter what are called threats from Iran. China has denounced the sailing of two U.S. warships through the Taiwan Strait, saying that the move undermines peace and stability.
China has closely followed and is full acknowledge of the U.S. warships passing through the Taiwan Strait. Recently, U.S. warships have repeatedly made a show of force for provocation and is stirring up trouble, which sends a wrong signal to Taiwan independence forces and severely undermines peace and stability across the strait. We are firmly opposed to it.
The Chinese Foreign Ministry spokesman says that his country will stay on high alert to respond to all threats. This is the second such mission by the U.S. this month, and it just comes 2 weeks after a Chinese aircraft carrier used the same waterway. China, that claims Taiwan as its own territory, has blamed Washington for interference in the island's affairs. The U.S. earlier infuriated China by arms sales to Taiwan and sailing warships through the strait, and that's the 13th sailing through the strait by the U.S. Navy this year. Time now for the News Review program. Do stay with us. The European Union has criticized the United States' move to impose additional tariffs on French and German products as part of a long-running dispute over subsidies for aircraft manufacturers, Airbus and Boeing. The European Commission criticized Washington's decision to add further EU products to its retaliation list. Brussels said it would seek a solution to the spat with the new U.S. administration. Also, Airbus said that Washington's decision is counterproductive and will harm its own workers and consumers. It urged Europe to respond appropriately to defend its interests. The U.S. move is the latest in the 16-year subsidy dispute between the aerospace giants. Last year, Washington imposed tariffs on $7.5 billion of annual EU imports, and the EU responded with duties on some $4 billion worth of U.S. products. Let's get some insight on this. The Robert Carter correspondent will join me from London, and Paolo Raffone, secretary of the SIPI Foundation out of Brussels. Welcome to the show, gentlemen. Robert, 16 years of this controversy going on. So tell us a bit more about it.
Sure. Well, obviously, this is just the latest update to, as you say, a very long-winded process, which has been going on for over a decade now. Ultimately, it's about governments funding and using subsidies to prop up businesses, which is, of course, affecting what should be a level playing field. So this is ultimately about governments using their ability to subsidize these major companies, in particular Boeing and Airbus, and that of course is upsetting and creating a lot of controversy as to whether or not it's giving them an unfair advantage over their competitors. So what's happening here, absolutely, yes. So what bothers me here is that the US, which has a long history of, you know, trying to dominate the global economy, dominating on all fronts, including military and geopolitical fronts. It seems as if under the Trump regime, they've decided to take matters into their own hands and escalate the conflict with what's historically been their ally, the European Union. So obviously the WTO, the World Trade Organization, has been trying to deal with this dispute for such a long time. But since Trump came in, he's basically threatened to walk from the WTO at one stage, saying that the organization was unfairly treating the US and was biased against them. And then, of course, he's escalated with these renewed sanctions on the EU. And as we know very well here at Press TV, US reckless sanctions don't really achieve much in the long run. Right. So ultimately, what's happened here is US-EU relations are at an all-time low. The EU seems to hope that the new U.S. administration will give them a chance to fix it, but who knows?
Now, turning to Brussels, Paolo, Airbus is saying that this will also harm workers and consumers inside the United States. Do you agree with that?
Yes, there is a possibility that this happens because, of course, these conglomerates have fabrication of items on either side of the Atlantic. So it is not impossible that there is a consequence on the economic ground also in the United States. On the other hand, this is the result of a long-lasting dispute between Europe and the United States. We will see what the Biden administration will bring, but for the time being, we do not see any signal to ease the situation.
So you mentioned the Biden administration, Paolo. Do you expect the problem to be addressed the right way when he comes to the White House?
I think it is part of the priorities because the transatlantic relations are a key issue to recover the hegemony leadership of the United States, and the solving the various disputes with Europe, and one of these is on trade issues and in the aerospace industry in particular, it is important because it would strengthen the cooperation on the two sides.
Okay, thank you very much for your comments. Robert Carter, correspondent, joined us from London, and Paolo Raffone, secretary of the CIPI Foundation out of Brussels. And that's the end of this edition of the News Review. Thank you for staying tuned. The long-awaited departure of the United Kingdom from the European Union will officially take effect tonight at 2300 GMT. The Queen has already signed a post-Brexit deal with the EU after Parliament approved it in the early hours of Thursday, allowing the country to avoid a no-deal divorce scenario. Prime Minister Boris Johnson said the destiny of his country now resides firmly in the hands of the British people. He described the UK's departure from the bloc as a new start, while keeping the EU as its biggest ally. The opposition Labour Party, that's a fierce opponent of Brexit, said it would push for greater prosperity, fairness, and opportunity with the country forging a new path in the world. Brexit has dominated British politics since the country's narrow vote to leave the bloc in June 2016, opening deep political and social issues. The father of British Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that he's applying for a French passport to maintain his ties with the European Union after Brexit. Stanley Johnson says that he will always be a European and that having ties with the EU is important. The Prime Minister's 80-year-old father says that he can acquire French citizenship because of his familial ties. Boris Johnson was the public face of the Leave campaign in the landmark 2016 referendum that led to Britain's exit from the EU. Starting 2021, UK citizens will face more red tape for traveling to EU countries. On Wednesday, Boris Johnson said that Britain will still remain a European country after its departure from the bloc single market and customs union. Madrid and London secured an 11th-hour preliminary deal to maintain the free movement between Spain and Gibraltar after Britain's departure from the EU. The Spanish foreign minister says that Gibraltar will join the Schengen zone to ensure fluidity on its border with Spain. Arancha González-Laya held the initial accord, expressing hope that it will serve as a foundation for a future treaty. Gibraltar was not addressed in the post-Brexit trade deal struck last week between London and Brussels. Failure to reach a deal would have meant the creation of a hard border between the UK and the EU. Around 15,000 Spanish citizens work in the tiny British territory located south of Spain. The world has begun to see 2020 off. New Year's celebrations have kicked off in easternmost countries, with coronavirus restrictions overshadowing the usual revelry. Firework displays took place at the iconic Sky Tower in New Zealand's largest city, Auckland. Similar events were held in Australia's major cities, including Sydney. People mostly watched the displays from home. They're waving goodbye to 2020 in distaste, as the year was ridden by the coronavirus pandemic. The contagion crippled lives and businesses across the globe. At least 1.7 million people have fallen victim to the disease so far. Hopefully this vaccination thing will take care of it. Now, the year 2020 was filled with exceptionally important events, massive rallies, wars, and destruction. And some people believe that the ongoing pandemic could put a stop to those events, but it did not. Let's have a review of the most noticeable incidents of the past year.
Donald Trump became the third U.S. president who faced an impeachment trial. Trump was accused of abuse of power for seeking help from the Ukrainian government in order to help himself get re-elected in the November presidential election. He was alleged to have held back millions of dollars of military aid to Ukraine and dangled a proposed White House meeting with the Ukrainian president, both as bargaining chips. In exchange, reports said the U.S. president wanted Ukraine to publicly announce an investigation into Joe Biden in order to challenge him in the election. Trump denied all accusations. The impeachment trial concluded with Trump's acquittal on February the 5th. U.S. President Donald Trump unveiled his Middle East plan in a White House press conference alongside Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. What Trump presented gave Israel what it had sought over decades of corruption while offering the Palestinians the possibility of a state with limited sovereignty. The plan discarded the long-time goal of granting the Palestinians a full-fledged state. While Trump called it a win-win for both sides, Palestinian leaders immediately rejected it. The global stock market crash, also known as the coronavirus crash, was a major global shock that shook the world. It was the fastest fall in financial history and the most devastating one since the Wall Street crash of 1929. It also signaled the beginning of the COVID-19 recession. A black man was brutally killed after being arrested by a white police officer outside a shop in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Footage of George Floyd's arrest shows police officer Derek Chauvin kneeling on the victim's neck while he was pinned to the floor. Floyd said more than 20 times he could not breathe as he was restrained by the officer.
Please, I can't breathe.
The killing of Floyd sparked yet another wave of nationwide anti-racism protests across the United States. To crack down on protesters, the government used different methods ranging from deploying the National Guard to threatening the use of armed forces against the people. The 59th quadrennial presidential election in the United States was held between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. The vote saw a record number of ballots cast early using the postal voting system due to the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. As a result of the large number of mail-in ballots, some swing states saw delays in vote counting and reporting. This led to major news outlets delaying their projection of Biden as the winner until November the 7th, 4 days after the election. Trump rejected the result and called the election rigged. His campaign and allies continued to engage in numerous attempts to overturn the results by filing dozens of legal challenges in several states. Most of the legal suits were dropped or dismissed by various courts.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Great hero, General of Hearts. The former commander of the IRGC Quds Force, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, the deputy commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Organization, Abu Mahdi al-Muhandis, and their 8 companions all attained martyrdom on 3rd of January 2020 in an act of terrorism directly ordered by the criminal US President Donald Trump. But what was the purpose of this nefarious act of terrorism on 3rd of January 2020 at Baghdad Airport? For sure, the terrorist act of assassinating the unmatched anti-terrorist hero was in continuation of US hostility against the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic of Iran. This hostility has continued incessantly for the past 42 years. Iranian nation's firm resistance in the face of all plots by the global arrogance has been a role model to regional nations and beyond. This public uprising among different nations has horrified the US and the Zionist regime. These nations are seriously indebted to the sincere and selfless efforts of martyrs like Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who totally changed the balance of power in the region. The United States tried for years to destabilize Iran, but in vain. The Daesh terrorist outfit was obliterated by the courageous endeavors of Martyr Soleimani and his fellow combatants from Iran, Syria, Iraq, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. This great development totally foiled the American conspiracy of disintegrating the region and turning it into a so-called Greater Middle East. The US dispatched thousands of forces to the region under the guise of fighting terrorism, but in practice it supported terrorism and didn't want to destroy the terrorists, as it was using them as a tool to further its own ends. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "The claim of formation of alliance against Daesh is a lie. Although the Americans are opposed to the controlled Daesh, they will confront anyone who wants to really destroy this terrorist Daesh group." Americans created the Daesh terrorist group in 2012 with the aim of overthrowing Bashar al-Assad, the legitimate government in Syria, and taking control of Iraq. But they faced enormous resistance and a roadblock called Qasem Soleimani. This came whilst the Americans waged bloody wars in the region in the name of fighting terrorism. Indeed, they have pillaged the wealth of Arab countries in the region. Donald Trump chose Riyadh for its first trip abroad after entering the White House. This was done with the same motive. He called the Arab regimes as milking cows. He tried to sell weapons and rescue America's bankrupt companies through Iranophobia. Alexander Konyazov, a Russian analyst, has commented on the assassination of General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. terrorist army. Alexander Konyazov, a top Russian analyst, said, "The fact that ISIL terrorists have been formed in the RAND think tank corporation is a clear and known issue. General Qasem Soleimani was a bulwark, a dam against materialization of Washington's plan to dehumanize the Middle East and then spread it to the other neighboring regions and the entire world. History will be the judge of everyone and everything, but General Qasem Soleimani has in fact turned into a historical figure in his own time." Dear listeners, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani mobilized and organized the resistance front against Takfiri terrorists, which were created and supported by the United States, the Zionist regime of Israel, and Saudi Arabia. The assassination of top General Qasem Soleimani was a turning point in the history of the region and the beginning of the end of U.S. hegemony in West Asia. American analyst Noam Chomsky says, "Instability is an interesting concept in the political discourse. When Iran helps the Iraqi government and Kurdistan in defense against ISIL terrorists, this measure is described as instability. But when the United States attacks Iraq and kills hundreds of thousands of innocent Iraqis, displaces millions of people, destroys the country and initiates sectarian clashes to disintegrate Iraq and disturb the entire region, and spread terrorism in the entire world, it is called a part of the American mission for stabilizing, which we should continue for the benefit of the world." The United States has breached and overtrodden international principles of law for the benefit of the Zionist regime of Israel and safeguarding its illegitimate interests in West Asia region. Iran's Defense Minister Brigadier General Amir Hatami says the assassination of top general Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani was carried out with the aim of resuscitating U.S. presence in the region and undermining Iran's regional influence and deterrence power. Brigadier General Amir Hatami said, "The people's presence in the scene and the IRGC's missile response annihilated the mock awe of the United States and the system of arrogance and proved Iran's defense power and might to the entire world." Najah Muhammad Ali, an Iraqi expert in international affairs, said, "Donald Trump's assassination of great General Mahdi Soleimani was a big mistake and he fell in a trap that had been prepared for getting rid of him." The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, said, "Thwarting all U.S. illegitimate designs for West Asia was an example of Mahdi Soleimani's bravery and courage." The leader added, "Americans tried to cast the issue of Palestine into oblivion and put the Palestinians in the weak position so that they would not dare to struggle. But this great man filled the hands of the Palestinians and gave them the courage and ability to struggle. The failure of the heavy and aggressive operation of the Zionists against Gaza in the recent years is a reality that has caused a nightmare for the United States and the leadership of the Zionist regime."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're going to be discussing the documentary Drone, directed by award-winning Norwegian filmmaker Tonya Hessen-Schae. And joining me in the studio, we have Tim Robey, who is a film critic for The Daily Telegraph and Radio 4's film programme, and Dan Blaisbrook, who's a journalist, political analyst, and author of the book Divide and Ruin, The West's Imperial Strategy in an Age of Crisis. Now, Drone is about the ultimate weapon in the war on terror. Through a mixture of original interviews, archive material, and simulations, Schae reveals crucial information about the workings of the covert CIA drone war, which the film argues has revolutionized killing, has turned war into a video game, and has had a devastating impact on human life in places such as Pakistan.
Imagine killing more than 1,500 enemies in war without ever stepping foot on the battlefield.
We are at war with an organization that would kill as many Americans as they could if we did not stop them first.
The drones have changed everything. It's the defining weapon of the war on terror.
It's never been easier for an American president to carry out a killing operation at the ends of the earth.
We are safer because of our efforts. These strikes have saved lives.
I didn't really understand what it meant to kill at first. We sat in a box. We were the ultimate peeping toms.
You never know who you're killing because you never actually see a face.
1,626 people were killed in the operations that I took part of.
How many of them do you think were innocent?
I'm the only one that really is vocal about it. It just blows my mind.
War is an unbelievably profitable business.
The military has invested in video games as recruiting tools.
How do we find our 18X pilots? How do we identify these people early?
I had no idea what I was in for. I wasn't even 20 years old at that point.
Dozens of highly skilled Al-Qaeda operatives have been taken off the battlefield.
The United States is violating one of the most fundamental rights of all, the right to life.
The truth is, the vast majority of people have no earthly idea what's happening here.
It is not justifiable killing unarmed, innocent civilians.
As a former RPA drone operator, I have concerns about how the drone community operates.
The U.S. has to explain what went wrong.
Drones have not caused a huge number of civilian casualties.
We've seen them make mistakes by the hundreds.
The rescuers were coming, and the CIA was coming back and bombing again.
I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war.
It's just point and click.
Well, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming. I must say this documentary really shook me. It was incredibly chilling, extremely informative, and raises a lot of serious questions about the morality of drone warfare. And Tim, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I think it's really good. It's a very kind of polished presentation of a lot of the arguments around drone warfare, which manages to cram a lot into quite a brief running time. In fact, it's only about an hour and 15 minutes long. But I particularly valued the range of perspectives in it because you get an awful lot of them. You get the kind of military perspective from a kind of critiquing position. You get the industrial perspective from a kind of constructor. You get the perspective of an actual drone operator. You get the ground level perspective of victims, particularly in Waziristan, where the CIA has been kind of most guilty of kind of really pushing the drone operation to its limit. And yes, the survivors and the families of victims are especially moving in that respect. And the overall kind of mosaic that's built up is quite damning, I think, and well put together in the edit.
I was going to say, there's a whole range of different people interviewed in this documentary that makes it really rich. And Dan, as someone who's familiar on this subject of drone warfare, what was your take on this documentary?
Yeah, I thought it was very good, and it really highlighted how what was once the kind of ultimate dystopian fantasy of the future, basically people being hunted by robots, is now a reality in places like Waziristan. And it really shows the juxtaposition between, as we saw there, the operatives who are, as far as they're concerned, playing a video game in the US and Virginia or wherever it is, and then the lives of people in Waziristan. And you know, there's this juxtaposition between this high, super high levels of technology, the most kind of advanced technology available to mankind, being visited upon one of the most underdeveloped regions on the planet. After seeing the film, I looked up some of the human development statistics for Waziristan. Mm-hmm. And it's shocking, less than 20% of the houses there have running water. More than a third lack electricity. There's one doctor per 1,000. Infant mortality is nearly 1 in 10. And yet the pretty much the only technology the rich world decides to send to these places is this industrial killing machine. And so that juxtaposition was really brought home. And you also saw the juxtaposition between the operatives who are often basically recruited literally as children and barely children through the video game industry, which they point out as
actually I want to talk about military. Yeah, the video game industry a bit later on is a good point, but I just want to briefly talk now, just before we go to our next clip, about the nature of drones. So it's a quick and easy death. Could you explain exactly how they work?
Well, they're a combination of three things, I suppose, aren't they? A camera, an airplane, and a missile. Mm-hmm. So the operative is controlling them remotely. There's no pilot on board, and they find their target, which, as they said, they don't actually see in great depth because the drones are very high. They can't see their faces, and this is part of what the film brings out very well as well, is the depersonalization of killing to make it easier to kill. As mentioned on the trailer, you never see their faces, and it shows later in the film about how they try to show the humanity to the operatives of the people they're killing by actually.
And that's actually a good point, because it leads us right to our next clip. Actually,
right.
We're going to see Brandon Bright now, who's a former drone operator.
I watched this man bleed out. The missile had taken it off one of his legs, right above the knee, and I watched him bleed out of his femoral artery. Rolling on the ground, and I imagined his last moments. I didn't know what to feel. I just knew that I had ended something that I had no right to end. But I swore an oath, did what I was supposed to do. I followed through with it. It was like my image of myself was cracking and breaking apart. And the safety observer laughs and he slaps me on the back and he says, "You should have seen how you jumped when I said splash." And he's laughing like it's the biggest joke in the world.
That was truly harrowing and sadistic, that. I mean, so that was Brandon Bryant, a former drone operator turned American whistleblower. Now, Tim, we can tell from the documentary, even though he's done some terrible things, he comes across as genuinely remorseful, and you can't help but feel sorry for him. Do you think this was an intentional part on behalf of the filmmaker?
Yeah, very much so. He's one of the most sympathetic interviewees, and his testimony is really quite powerful. It helps that he's so photogenic. His sort of, if you like, his turning, the change of his mind and opinion about it, reminded me of the way that it's been dramatized for feature films, actually. There's a film called Good Kill with Ethan Hawke playing a very similar figure who is an operator who really kind of suffers this sudden crisis of conscience. And I think it's very well put across, actually. And he's very articulate at it in his kind of quiet way. And it's important that people like him are stepping forward to make the point, in fact, that, you know, the real cost morally is to them, not to their superiors, not to the people telling them what to do, but to the actual people clicking the button, if you like. And the idea of being kind of instructed, for instance, to perform one of the so-called double tap strikes, where, you know, you drop a bomb, and then people come in to try and help the wounded and the victims, and then drop another bomb in the same site. The idea of being the person who's actually having to physically click the button, send in death to a bunch of completely innocent civilians who are just simply on the scene to help, would really haunt you for the rest of your life, I think. And that's the feeling we get from this guy.
Yeah, we get that sense of the psychological impact it has on the former drone operators. And Dan, in the documentary, it seems as though they were duped into the job. You could tell he was conflicted. And can you explain more on that?
Well, yeah, he talks about one. In fact, it's interesting you say about him kind of turning, but in fact, he says right from the start, before he press the button on anyone, about having this feeling like he didn't think he'd be able to kill anyone. And he tells his superior, and the superior tells him, well, sorry, but you signed the oath, you have to.
And so, surely it must be okay then.
Right. Well,
it's cognitive dissonance then.
Exactly. Partly it must be okay, but I think more than that, he doesn't see a way out. And he talks about not being allowed to see a therapist because that break, he loses his security clearance. Goes to see a chaplain. The chaplain says it's part of God's plan. Basically, it's fine. So he's in doubt about it from the start. But it really shows, like I was saying before, they're kind of recruited as children playing video games, and then they literally start doing it still as teenagers. Often, the other drone operative there. The interview started when he was 19, I think. I'm not sure when this guy started, but it really shows, I think, the kind of institutionalized child abuse, really, on both in both the U.S. and Waziristan. They're killing children. They've targeted 16-year-olds before. Maybe they've targeted younger children. Way younger children have been killed as innocent bystanders. But the children in the U.S. who they're recruiting and mm-hmm. getting to do this stuff are permanently damaged. Well, they're permanently damaged if they have any empathy. But obviously, part of drone warfare is to try and get rid of empathy on the side of the operatives as well.
I think it desensitizes them in a lot of sense as well. And I think, Tim, one of the major issues also in this documentary is the video game industry and its relationship with the military. Could you explain to us a bit more about that in the film?
Yeah, this is a significant kind of subplot, if you like. And they talk about how instead of recruiting meatheads these days, there's one person interviewed who says that in fact they're now looking for the geeks. You know, basically the kids who are really good at these war games, the Tom Clancy Ghost Recon type war games. And there's this sort of weird conference that you can see set up where they're all kind of testing out these games, and the military is sort of crawling around trying to find who the most skillful players are, because that's going to be the next generation of operators and recruits. It's not a new thing for the military to exploit extremely young soldiers. I mean, look at Vietnam, look at the ages of kids being sent into Vietnam, for instance. But it's certainly a new technology that's enabling it to happen from a whole world away, and to happen in a way that is very veiled and controlled, so that the moral question is removed from the equation.
Mm-hmm. So then it's essentially glamorizing and normalizing warfare in the form of video games. It's a really fascinating subject.
War is an unbelievably profitable business. The development of robotic warfare, and particularly drones, is having a huge impact on the trade in arms generally, because it's causing the big defense contractors to rethink their business models and how they're going to sell enough drones to be able to make the sorts of profits that they're making on the big ticket, very expensive items, aircraft carriers, jet fighters, etc. So I think what that is going to do is ensure that we see produced far more drones than even your very hawkish security analyst would think that the world needs. And these companies are huge. And you only have a few of them in every country, closely linked to their governments.
Well, it's funny to think that, which the documentary mentions, that drones were originally invented to help fishermen find tuna fish. And you wouldn't think that, but of course that wasn't profitable, so they weaponized them. So Tim, what are your thoughts on this? Is this a worrisome endeavor, the prospect of drones and as business?
Well, absolutely. I mean, as any kind of business concern tied to warfare would disturb you, this does. I think for me the single most disturbing implication of the film is the idea that terrorism is providing an excuse for the U.S. military to develop this technology, and for someone uses the phrase the terrorist industrial complex. The idea that, you know, if they're out there, we've got to keep doing this stuff, we've got to keep building it, we've got to keep getting better and better at killing people. And warfare becomes a permanent state rather than one that you declare and then you declare over. It becomes a permanent state because at any point you can click and send in death to anywhere in the world. That is extremely disturbing, I think, and the film brings it up quite smartly. I could have watched another whole film on that topic, actually, that much broader topic.
Yeah. And what were your thoughts on the advancement of military technology and drones as a business?
Yeah, it's very worrying, and it's I agree with Tim that it's setting the stage for permanent war, not just permanent war, but also war without geographical boundaries. The whole world is a battlefield in the global war on terror, So they opened, I think, right at the start of the film. They say, well, the US is not at war with Pakistan, mm-hmm. and yet it's sending out these bomber planes.
I wanted to ask you, because mm-hmm. it does mention that, but why is the US at war with Pakistan then?
Well, I mean, I think what is missing from the film, this isn't necessarily a criticism, because I don't think it's not trying necessarily to explain the politics of it so much as present just a picture of what's happening.
Presenting the facts, right.
Right, but the politics are slightly absent, and I think the politics of it are that so it comes across very disturbing, but at the same time, I think we should be aware that really this is not a sign of US omnipotence. Far from it, it's actually a sign of desperation, because the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan were so costly in terms of blood and treasure, and blood to their own side, that basically Colin Powell said in 2006 the US Army is broken. It meant the resistance to those wars meant they could not continue. They could basically ruled out the prospect of any similar mass occupation by US forces. So what we've seen as a response to that is this new type of warfare, which has got two elements. Part of it is drone warfare, and part of it is proxy wars, where you're recruiting mm-hmm. local militia to basically do the fighting in place of US soldiers. Mm-hmm. So that's part of what's driving it, I think. I don't think it's all about the profits of the military and so on. It's
strategic. Would you have liked to see that in the film? Thanks, Dan, for the explanation. But would you have liked to see more context?
Especially about Waziristan, I think, because it's such a sort of strange theatre for them to have encroached into, and the attacks there are much more prolific than anywhere else. Mm. So we see the kind of suffering, but we don't have any sense of the motive. It's very peculiar. And that was a problem for me. I mean, a lot of the kind of deaths and the damage there are obviously collateral, and they're civilian deaths, no matter how much, you know, the US government would like to not deny that those are happening in large quantities. And there's an interesting kind of contradiction in terms of the technology developing, I think, because the more sophisticated and targeted it can become, with any luck, you would find fewer of those civilian casualties. So there's this peculiar thing. The film does raise that point slightly, and I found that an interesting kind of counter argument, if you like. Mm-hmm. I thought it was an interesting wrinkle in the thesis, because yes, the more targeted they get, if drone warfare is going to be allowed to remain legal, well, that is in fact preferable than just the kind of blanket bombing approach.
Well, I think that's slightly
right. Apology there, gentlemen. Sorry, we'll continue this in the next part of the discussion, as we're going to fast forward towards the end of the film now.
The United States has become a national security state whose raison d'etre is war. We've created a terrorist industrial complex that is self-perpetuating, and now searching for the reason for this constant state of war, terrorism is the perfect case for us. We can do this forever.
It just feels like we're going to like a bad science fiction novel. If we dehumanize war, if we take the human aspect out of it, what's to stop us from just sending a bunch of automaton robots into another country and let them wipe out the entire population? People were writing about this in like the early 1900s. What could happen? And we're watching it happen.
Tim, would you agree with that statement? Is that one of the main messages that this film leaves you with?
Yeah, the desensitization of violence and warfare is, again, one of the most unsettling aspects of this. And the idea that you're not in combat face-to-face, you're in combat halfway around the globe. And I do think that the attempts to bring a kind of moral or understanding to those involved, and this is, they do things like trying to put big posters of children's faces over the top of buildings in Waziristan, so that the operators, you know, with the drone cameras, will have to see their target before they press the button, will have to make that decision. But you suspect that the US military will still find people that they can kind of bully into pressing the button, and that's the really disturbing thing. Mm-hmm. And the kind of psychological cost on those those soldiers, if you like, must be extraordinary. And how they are, the legality of it is another question. And another very interesting point raised by a legal professor at the end is, you know, even if through some kind of loophole, the CIA is allowing, is kind of making the argument that this is in fact legal war, the question is, should it be? The question is, do we want that to be declared legal? Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's not enough to say, yes, this is technically legal. You have to sort of say, well, should it be?
Well, Dan, sorry. Sorry, were you going to say
that's
more?
Fine.
Dan, would you agree? But President Obama, though, says that drones saves lives and kills lots of terrorists in one go. How accurate is that claim?
Well, I'd say two things. It's not accurate. We know there have been hundreds of... I think what I was going to say is a red herring a little bit to say that there's to make this distinction between who's targeted and who's the bystander. On the one hand, there have been huge numbers of bystanders killed. They're not that targeted. They had footage from one drone strike that killed 44 people. I've read a study that suggests 8% only of the victims of drone strikes have been actual known al-Qaeda operatives. But I think even that making that distinction is false. The most interesting point I thought made by anyone on the film was a Pakistani lawyer, Shahzad Akbar, who says, Westerners always ask me the same thing. How many civilians have been killed in these strikes? He said, my answer is they're all civilians. He says, no one's ever proved that they're militants. They've never been on trial. There's been no evidence presented. And I think this really illustrates what lies behind, as you say, they'll always find people willing to press the button. Now, why is that? What's driving this more than any military-industrial complex is racism. It really shows the relevance, I think, of Frantz Fanon's concept of a zone of non-being. Basically, since the conquest of the Americas, the Europeans have treated non-Europeans as less than human. And places like Waziristan, you don't have to respect the rule of law, you don't have to respect due process. And as the lawyer says, people in Waziristan seem to be treated guilty until proven innocent.
And so that is a powerful really message that it leaves you, that you can take that interpretation. But Tim, what message does this documentary leaving you with in 30 seconds or so?
Yeah, it's this kind of the lack of geographical boundaries and the kind of the idea of being watched, if you are declared an enemy of the US government, the state of total paranoia that you would live in, knowing that these things are flying over your heads, it makes that very clear. There's a very good image as well of the Waziristan children with catapults trying to shoot up into the sky, which is a brilliant David versus Goliath image of their impotence in the face of this really all-pervasive threat.
Yeah, and how helpless they are. I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for coming on Doc Review. And that's it for this episode. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.